Welcome to the BFM Historical Society. This week, we talk to Steve Simpson. Former lead singer of the group Pash, Steve has filled many, many different roles at BFM over the years. He remembers some of those jobs. Steve Simpson, welcome to the BFM Historical Society.
Pleasure to be here, David. Thank you.
Now, Steve, you've done a lot of, you've filled a lot of different roles at BFM over the years. Can you start at the beginning and tell us when you first got involved?
The first thing was as a listener, obviously, as a fan. And I'd come up from Christchurch with my drummer. We were supposed to come up as a full band, but we lost a member along the way. And we came to Auckland in 93 and ultimately formed Pash later that year when we got Clem. But yeah, we were just huge fans of BFM. It was just completely different to anything that we had in Christchurch. You know, I used to listen to RDU a little bit, but it wasn't really my thing. And then commercial radio had turned me off. I'd been a huge radio fan when I was a kid, but yeah, you know, you soon get sick of it as you get older. And so yeah, BFM just seemed to sort of be the dream radio station. It really appealed to me compared to RDU, for instance, which is now, it was Radio U then, yeah, and it's now RDU in Christchurch, BFM's sister station. Yeah, I think Radio U was a bit more student-y and a bit more kind of PC, and coming to Auckland and hearing BFM, it was a lot more entertaining, a lot of real talent, and actually quite un-PC. As a listener, I loved it. It was funny and it was cutting edge, and it had all this great talent. Marcus Lush was on Breakfast, and it had fantastic hits. It was kind of, I'm not sure who was program director at the time, maybe Graham or something, but it definitely was able to generate hit songs. And so it was just really exciting, and it was something to really aspire to, obviously, as a band, to get on there, because, you know, there was basically, at least the way I saw it, a hierarchy of, you know, you were either on BFM or you weren't, you know, and so we desperately wanted to get on there, get our band on there, which took a while because we just had really crap demos, and we were called Love Freak when we arrived in town. But yeah, there was sort of quite a lot of love bands at the time. I think there was Love Buzz and Love Gone Crazy, and there was all of that going on. And so we changed our name to Pash. We came up with a demo, and I actually had a family connection with Johnny Leach, and I think our song that we came up with managed to get played a couple of times, but nothing really ever happened with it. And then Pash recorded demos that were just a little bit average, and they never quite made it on. And you know, we weren't a particularly alternative band, but BFM also provided that kind of opportunity for any kind of band, you know, well, within reason. I always have seen BFM as a pretty broad church, and it used to play a lot of pretty alternative stuff, but also stuff coming right into what was essentially mainstream. And a lot of the time, you know, BFM was playing it basically because nobody else was, and particularly at that time in the early to mid 90s, a lot of stuff converged musically around the world. All these sort of, you know, genres were taking off. Obviously, grunge was huge, hip hop and house music and breakbeat and all of this stuff, and nobody was playing it except for BFM. They just owned this enormous territory. We ended up doing a little tour with Thorazine Shuffle, and Josh became a very good buddy of mine. And on the back of that, we, I guess just playing a few nights in a row tightened us up, and we thought, right, let's go record. And Tony from Future Stupid had said to me, you should go and record with this guy. I can't even remember his name. And he did a good recording for us. That was when we finally got some traction on the station. Yeah, they played Uneasy Street, and then Doo Wop, and then we had our little stint as a BFM band, which was glorious. It was like 96 by then, so it was just a little flash in the pan. But during that time, we had heaps of songs on the station. All right, well, what about we play Uneasy Street? Yeah, it was our first song that got regular play on BFM. So, yeah, this is it, Uneasy Street. Don't show what you know, 'cause you don't want it to slow you down. Don't show the debate was happening on air in a way, you know, where, you know, some, you know, so that there were these, you know, different genres of music, and some of the DJs loathed it and, you know, wouldn't mind saying so on air. And you know, and even some of the ads at the time, I remember reflecting that with, you know, some of them were poking fun at dance music and all of this sort of stuff. It was actually, I guess that was a thing about BFM. It was actually its own kind of whole culture with its disagreements and different opposing factions and everything else, all within, you know, one radio station. And, you know, the commercial radio stations just seemed like this distant, massive offshore island that was irrelevant, you know, and full of just garbage, you know. You know, really middle of the road artists like Beck Runger was first played on BFM.
Yes.
And so, right. You know, and so was Golden Horse, you know, and, you know, who also became a celebrated darlings of commercial radio. And, you know, that's been the role for BFM. And, you know, and I think it's still playing that role. Obviously, the environment now is a lot more conducive. There's actually a music industry here now. There's a touring circuit and, you know, I don't know, you might know, Dub, but I think the percentage of local music played on radio stations across the borders, somewhere over 20%. The percentage at the time of local music that was on radio across the border in New Zealand was 2%. It was just dire, you know. It was just wasn't happening. So yeah, there's been a huge shift since then, which is, you know, which is good news really. Time rolled by and Pash kind of fell to pieces, and it became 1998, and I was trying to get a solo career happening that wasn't really happening, although I did get Is the Party Over on BFM. And then, yeah, I was recording a few other songs and it was just trying to make it happen, but I didn't really have a clue. Tell me now, baby, is the music stopping?
Something new.
I think it was one time I was up here trying to give Bill a song, and they were looking for a new breakfast producer. This was in late 98. I think it was after Gemma had and Mikey had parted ways, and they were trying out a few. And he says, "What about you, Steve?" And I said, "Why not?" And so in the end, I ended up doing that for a year, over a year, probably a year and a half, producing Mikey's show.
Wow.
And I mean, I've been a huge fan of the BFM Breakfast Show for years, and you know, particularly Marcus and then Graham. And then Mikey was quite a different flavour. He was quite controversial at the time because he was sort of well known, at least especially when he first started on the station, as being the singer from Push Push, which was a band that BFM hadn't played. But when I started working with him, he just immediately blew me away with his talent, you know. And it's, I guess it's one of the things that you don't hear on his show, is just, you know, obviously he's pretty visual as well, and he's pretty entertaining, And so yeah, that was a really good time, and it was a bit of a sort of a, it was a bit of a rude awakening for me. It was sort of you know, I was getting up at 5:15, and getting in here because I had to man the desk from 6 till 7, or actually, let's be honest, sort of 7:40
when Mikey
showed up, yeah. And so yeah, and I played a lot of music over that period. It was on the radio and got quite adept at the desk, and also right about the very first week that I started in that job, Gemma put me on The Wire as well. And so it was, you know, it was all of a sudden I'd sort of made a bit of a transition, and I think there are a couple of people thought it was a little bit premature, but I had, you know, I was politically interested, and I think Gemma had picked that up, and just kind of, you know, decided that I was suited to it. Yeah, although Mikey did bring me in on quite a regular occasion, and he renamed me Natalie.
Natalie, that's
and,
right.
And that was, I think, an attempt to just demasculate, you know, the experience of there being two guys talking on radio. I wasn't so sure about it, to be honest. You know, I saw the entertainment value, so yeah, and it was good fun. We used to sort of, I was always there for the quiz every morning, and there was a lot of fun there, and I'm sure a lot of listeners will remember Poveygate, when we were so thrilled to nail this guy who had come in under a different name and was just about to win the whole shebang of all the prizes, and so we set it up with sirens and, you know, the music to Bad Boys, and yeah, it was good fun. It was good fun. Yeah, and then I think from there I went to Monday Drive just to sort of try and relieve that kind of pressure that I felt. And I did Monday Drive for a while, and I don't know, I was just kind of looking for that show that felt like the right time slot, you know. And I sort of hopscotched between Drive and The Wire, not quite sure exactly what the best one was. Because then from Monday Drive I went back to The Wire and did the Wednesday Wire. I think I did the Wednesday Wire for quite a while. Yeah. Then a full-time job came up as brand manager. And
here we go.
And that was, I think, 2000. And yeah, I did that job for a couple of years. And that was a great job. That was sort of, you know, you're involved in all the BFM events. The main one of the year always, the BNET Music Awards. Music. And the Hero Parade float. I remember there was a controversy one year. I can't remember if you remember Dubhead, but there was a lot of debate. I mean, the thing about, you know, working at BFM is, you know, people are coming from a lot of different perspectives, and they're all very passionate. They all have their own idea about what they think BFM means, and they're all working for that idea rather than the boss, if you know what I mean. And so everybody's got their own principles, and so, you know, there was some pretty robust debate on certain things. And then especially when it came to something like BFM's presence at an event, there would be debate on exactly, you know, how that was supposed to look.
Oh, yeah.
And we went back and forth on the Hero Parade for a long time, and eventually just decided to form this band and play on the back of a truck, which we did. There was real disapproval that was, you know, not the right thing to do leading up to it. It all turned out fine in the end. And yeah, we did. So we formed this band that dressed up in relatively camp
was that
outfits.
Neon Lines?
No, Neon Lines was different. Neon Lines played after the Music Awards one year.
Yeah.
At the we didn't really have occasion to go by name, but amongst ourselves we were known as the Ghost Straits. And we played a couple of covers. I think we played Iggy Pop's Lust for Life and David Bowie's We Can Be Heroes. And that was a total blast. We were the loudest float in the parade. And we had a whole lot of BFM people, including Havoc and Newsboy, on the float, and the naysayers, including Mikey. Mikey had been very opposed to the idea of having a rock band. He thought it was old school and whack. But he publicly ate his hat on the air the following week. And said no, it was great. So And then in that role, we were also doing all of the BFM merchandise and advertising posters and all of that sort of stuff. It's probably boring for most listeners. You know, one of Mikey's great skills was, in that era, and I guess he still is, but particularly during that era, he was a bit of a hit maker. And if he chose a song and really got behind it, then it could really go through the roof, and you know they could come and tour and pack it out all on the strength of Mikey's support. And he was, I guess, a suited person at the time, because he was really, you know, part rock and roll, part dance music, part a little bit of everything else, and that was happening musically at the time with the Chemical Brothers. This song here was one of Mikey's favourites, and a great song. It was the Chemical Brothers. It is the Chemical Brothers remix of Spiritualized's I Think I'm in Love.
I got nothing.
Well, there's also, yeah, you know, if you got his buy-in as well. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm sure it's been referred to already, but you know, like for instance, Mercury Rev, you know, and Mikey was just bananas about that song Holes, and he kind of made it huge, you know, and then that band sort of, I mean, I attribute it to him, you know, somebody else might not, but I do. Yeah, he was so crazy about that song that other people really bought into that. His mob did, and you know, and then Mercury Rev came out and sold out the power station. And then I had a baby, and my baby girl Heidi. Yeah, so I needed to, during that period, I kind of stopped doing shows. I just got a bit busy. It all got a bit full on, and then also the very meager wages I was on. Didn't seem like quite enough to support a family, and so I took a bit of a stab, and at the start of 2002 became a sales rep at BFM, and I had the right kind of preparation, and then I'd spent 2 years, I guess, essentially immersed in the BFM brand as brand manager, and then also, you know, a lot of on-air stuff. So and that was me for the next quite a few number of years. I spent a lot of years in BFM sales, which was an interesting place to be because, you know, obviously sales brings in the revenue for BFM and is a key part to the whole process. At the same time, it's a little bit outside of the BFM ethos. You know, there's a very strong sense of editorial independence and musical credibility and I guess kind of an unimpinged sort of search for new talent and nobody tells us what to do and all of this sort of stuff. It was a pretty cool job. It was just, you know, if you were meeting a new client and then you found out they were a BFM listener, you know, it always brought this huge surge of joy because you knew, you know, your work was basically done for you.
Yeah, you
know,
didn't have to explain everything.
The difference between talking to somebody and saying, well, this is what BFM's like, and talking to somebody who was already a fan, I mean, it's just a huge gulf, you know. And basically a lot of the – which made it a pretty cool job because it meant that most of the people who advertised on BFM, at least to some degree, got it. They were either listeners or they understood that, you know, if they didn't get it, they kind of knew they didn't get it, but they knew that, you know, they wanted to be on it. And so they kind of try and put on a bit of a different hat for it because, you know, it was there were a lot of brands that wanted to be on BFM because it was the cutting edge station and there were a lot of cutting edge DJs on the station. And so it was a lucky place to be, really. You know, lots of, well, actually, I don't really want to go into specific brands and specific clients, but, you know, it was, they kind of bought into the ethos of the station. They wanted to be part of it. And then as a sales rep, it was your job to basically try and make sure that they got what they wanted, which was a good BFM ad that worked without... You know, I mean, every now and again you're presented with a bit of a challenge from the creative department, which by then, when I started, it was pretty much, I think, Bob and Scott had moved on and it was Dan Sperber, Dan, and then Dan and Richard Larson, and then ultimately Wallace and Richard Larson, and then later Richard Larson and Paul. Now just Paul. Every now and again you'd get an ad that poked a little fun at the client, and, you know, I guess that's where you earned your money. Trying to sort of massage that one through and whether you could sell it into the client or whether you could get the guys in creative to maybe just take a bit of a different tone. And that's, you know, because there's a tricky little high wire act there when you're sort of saying to the client, look, you may not think that this represents what you do very well, but let me tell you it does. And I guess that's what the reps are still doing now as well. It's all just part and parcel. Eventually I did a little bit, I got back into doing a show. I didn't do one for probably over a year. So I did a bit of a stewardship of the show on Thursday for about 3 months, the notorious Thursday drive. And in those days it was, I believe it was Dunk the Funk used to bring in the liquor.
That's right.
And the professor would show up and, And you know, it was a dangerous place to be. So it carries on. It really does. It's brazen on air boozing, and I'm sure there's a little bit of that that goes on in radio elsewhere, but maybe there isn't. But at least if there is, it's certainly not as brazen as it is and still is to this day. During that period, Mikey had left and Hugh had taken over as the Breakfast Show host. And, you know, I'd actually been hoping for a little crack at that, but I'd kind of been out of the picture, you know, and so the timing was, and, you know, Hugh was very much a deserving, long-serving guy there. But during that period, I had actually done quite a bit of substituting on the Breakfast
on
Show.
On Breakfast.
Just as a substitute. And so I believe Hugh was doing the Breakfast Show when there was a bit of a reshuffle. I think it was when Mikey had come back and he was doing Saturday morning. Anyway, Mikey shifted back to doing an everyday slot. He was doing 10 to 12.
Yes.
And he brought his Saturday morning name with him, Trailer with a Cage.
That's right.
The professor did Saturday mornings for a period. Good morning, professor. Yes. But
Friday night was becoming a problem
for
him.
It was. There were issues. And so a gap opened up there, and somebody, I don't know whether it was Pat Fife or Aaron Carson, one of them suggested that me and Jeremy Wells should do the show together. And so we gave it a try and had a blast, and ended up doing it for nearly 3 years, Saturday Special. That was the longest show that I, you know, regular show that I hosted. It was kind of tough going because I was working at the station 5 days a week and then coming in on a sixth morning. Mm. But we had a lot of fun. And about halfway through the tenure, we discovered drinking. You know, look, I don't pretend to be anything other than I am, Dub. And during that period, I was both sales rep and on air. And there was sometimes the opportunity to set up, you know, something that had a little, what's the word? It was sort of integrated,
yes,
shall we say.
Yeah. And promotional opportunity, that's what I call it.
Promotional opportunities. I knew I'd be able to execute them, you know, as they were needed to be executed, because it was my job during the week to make sure that that happened. Mm. And somewhere along the line, one of the liquor clients had invited us to this tequila testing, and me and Jeremy went to this quite swanky tequila testing where there was a four-course meal and there was a different hundred and something dollar tequila that you tried with every meal, and it was supposed to go with
compliment the food,
all of this and that, and then they gifted us this bottle of Herradura tequila, and you know, and I can't remember if they asked us to try it on air or whether I volunteered it, but at any rate we said, okay, we'll try that on air for you. And so we did. We gave it a testing, and lo and behold, it tasted fantastic, and seemed to help the show go better.
The show went smoothly.
The show just went really well. We decided to put a little dent in that bottle that week, and then decided to have another one the following week, and then the following week we polished it off. And that week, I remember my dad came up. My dad was pushing some book or exhibition. I mean, he might have curated an exhibition. I can't exactly remember what it was, but he came up for an interview, and he came in and he saw the bottle. Saw we were drinking straight tequila, expensive tequila, listeners. And I'd sort of forgotten to sort of put it away, and so offered him one, and he readily accepted. So there I was on a Saturday morning on air with my dad drinking straight tequila. And I think, you know, the Saturday Special really found its stride at that point. But by the time we wound it up, it was time to sort of reclaim our Saturdays because, yeah, they took a terrible toll. Mm. All right. Yes, well, what about this one? I remember I am quite proud that I came into the Saturday Special the morning after I got married. And so got married on a Friday night and had a party, and then thought, well, what the hell? I might as well. I wasn't going away. We went for a honeymoon a couple of days later. I thought I might as well do the show. And so dragged my sorry ass out of bed and did the show. the song that had been, Shirley and I both played a song at our wedding, and she did a Bjork song, and I played Ryan Adams, This Is It, This Is It Happening, and which I thought was suitable. Ryan Adams, he's probably my favourite artist, and an example of the type of artist that BFM really just owns. You know, everybody should know about him, but you know, he's quite a mainstream artist, but you know, he's never going to get played on any other radio station, and so this was a huge song for me on BFM. This Is It.
Sleeping, let me sing a song for you.
Yes, we had the sheriff that we'd sourced. This, you know, he was from Jasper County, Texas, and you know, he was a sheriff of what was you know, one of the most racist counties in America. They'd had that killing of the guy Bird, who'd been dragged behind a truck. That's how we'd come to know who he was in the first place, and got hold of him to come and speak to us regularly. So, and this was during a. It was a very anti-American period, because you're talking Iraq War, George W. Bush. You know, he was very unpopular. And what I really loved about the sheriff was that he was this constant reminder that middle America, southern America, Bush-type characters are not all bad. In fact, they can be very charming and entertaining. I'd love to know what he's up to now, actually, because during the period of the show, he retired. And then we gave him a call, and... you know, he sounded quite blue. He was on his rocking chair on the porch out in his, you know, home in the in Jasper County, and missed it real bad. And then another time we spoke to him, and he said, yeah, he was going to throw his hat in the ring for re-election to sheriff, because sheriffs get elected in the US. And so hopefully he's
might have got his job back.
I still have, I've never found out. I've never Googled it or whatever. But yeah, I think he's probably still, because he was very popular. And yeah, in fact, and he told us a great story, because there was a movie made about him over the whole, well, there's a movie made about that whole incident.
That's right.
And he was played by John Voight. And he had a surprise, I think it was a 60th birthday party or something like that. And his assistant got hold of us and she, through some difficulty, got hold of me and asked if we would send a video message to the sheriff, me and Jeremy. And so he, and so we did. And we sent it over to him. And then the next time we talked to him, he was just thrilled. And he told us that John Voight had been, that's Angelina Jolie's father, by the way, had been at his party, been invited, because he obviously had played him. And he said, who the hell are those guys? And you know, Sheriff, what's his name? Sheriff Rolls. What's his name? Was, yeah, said, oh, you know, you're not going to believe this, but I, you know, I do a piece with a couple of guys down in New Zealand on their radio, and that's them there. And he'd never seen us before. And so, yeah, it was an interesting little thing for him as well to be talking to. He liked our accents.
Another very memorable moment was when Mike King called and left a message for Newsboy, and he was irate. He was, like, genuinely really angry.
Yeah, well, that was, I mean, that was on Jeremy's cell phone. And so, yeah, and that was to do with Jeremy's TV show, and they'd poked some fun at, you know, Mike King had that talk show for a while, which was just diabolical. It was awful. And Eating Media Lunch poked some fun at it. And, well, no, I don't know how that got out, but that got out. That was on the 6 o'clock news. I mean, that became, and the front page, I mean, it was quite scandalous. And because Mike King was basically threatening Jeremy. Yeah, it was pretty turbulent times for Jeremy through that period, because that was also the period that he kind of went out on his own, and, you know, that had come with some controversy. So, it was an interesting time. Yeah, that's about that on that one, Dubby.
So, Steve, Saturday Special, you were saying, ran for at least 3 years.
Well, actually, our very last show was the last show of 2005. We called it something like our Christmas Bonanza Season's Greeting Special, and promised lots of guests and lots of everything, and none of them showed up. We used to sort of involve phone callers quite a bit, I don't know, it was probably annoying for a lot of listeners, but it's, you know, sometimes it seemed like it was definitely getting a bit of a roll happening. Anyway, on this particular morning that we'd billed as a real festive occasion, you know, the callers went dead, and it just kind of petered out, and we kind of sort of knew that we'd maybe run our course, and we had a bit of a conversation afterwards, and because, you know, it was quite a commitment that sixth day of the week. Jeremy was also playing cricket at 12:30. We'd always had as the tagline for the show, it's got potential. We never quite fulfilled the potential, but we didn't feel we could keep claiming that anymore. You know, there's only so many number of years you can claim that you've got potential. Retrospectively, you've got to hope that at some point it did. You know, I'm the first to admit there's a lot of below average material as well. And I think listeners who used to listen to the Saturday Special will know that's true. I did a little stint as sales manager that I worked through under three different station managers. And the last one was, well, the first one was Suzanne, and that was for about 4 years. And then I worked under Aaron for about 4 years. And a lot happened during that period. I would say, Dub, that I had what I would call BFM drama fatigue. There was a lot of drama. There was, you know, like I was saying earlier, people have very passionate positions on BFM and what it stands for. And then there was always financial pressure and other people thinking that BFM should be more commercial, and others who thought it should ditch any events or anything like that, and people who thought we should play this and people who thought we should play that. I could never tell whether it was just the people I knew having constant conversations about the pros and cons of this and that, but it did get exhausting. And so when a new station manager, Helen, took over in late 2005, early 2006 is when she really started, I'd sort of already decided I wasn't really ready for another era. I felt like I'd done two long eras of certain stewardships, and so it was time for me to get out to the big wide world and see what was out there. This has always happened with BFM staff members who have worked there for a long time. They can then listen to the station and be free of all the associating drama or whatever else you're listening for, where you kind of know too much of the behind the scenes. And it really is quite a perspective shift to then just be able to come back and listen to the station. And I've been listening to the station a lot, and, you know, it's still great. It still plays that role. You know, the whole environment has changed, and there are a lot more stations. You know, obviously George came along, and that was always something that got discussed a lot, you know, because they came along and picked a lot of BFM talent. They still do. There's a lot of BFM people on that station. And but then all these other stations cropped up as well, like Bass and K and Fleet and a number of others. And some pretty good stations there, you know, playing some pretty good music. But BFM has still got that kind of unique, that identity, and it's got that huge base of volunteers, and it's got the frequency and the infrastructure and, you know, the know-how and lots of experts, and it's just, you know, I still find it a real treat to listen to. And I mean, I do flick around, but my default station is always BFM, and I still love it. There's a whole lot of people I don't know. I don't know what they look like. I've never met them. They're young. And it took a while for that to happen. You know, for the first sort of year or two from when I was out, I sort of knew, I still knew the show schedule and every DJ, and could picture them doing their show. Now it's actually got a bit more of that mystery. Not at the whole time, because there's still some very long-serving hosts on there who, you know, I kind of do feel like I know how they operate. But there's a whole bunch of other guys coming through as well, and that's great to see, because, you know, one of BFM's key aspects is it has always been a finder of new talent, and sometimes that's talent finding BFM, but either way, it means that, you know, it's a station you need to be listening to, because, you know, stuff is happening here. It's combusting. You know, and it's been the same for you. It was home for many years, and it was just nice to be involved with something that, you know, that I believed in, and felt passionate about, and that provided such a range of entertainment and opportunities and all of that sort of stuff. And and you know, when I think back to when I first arrived in Auckland, I was such a fan, and I just gravitated towards it, I guess, as so many people do. And so yeah, long may it rain. Back in the mid 90s, my band Pash was playing a lot around with local bands, particularly Thorazine Shuffle. Well, this is what it's all about, isn't it? A trip down memory lane. Here's Thorazine Shuffle's first single, An Affair. Yeah.
crisis because of their own fears.
Yeah, so BFM really owned a whole lot of music genre areas in the early mid-90s. There was a lot of pretty commercial rock, but at the time they were just great BFM hits, and including bands like Everclear that turned out to be a pretty mainstream band, but they were very much taking a leaf out of the grunge book. It was sort of and it had that kind of grunge sort of ethos and imagery around it, but I always just thought this was just such a ripping single, worthy of any radio station, but I loved that BFM owned it, and yeah, so it's Everclear, Heroin Girl.
I used to know a girl, she had two pierced nipples and a black tattoo. We drink that Mexican beer, we live on Mexican food. Yeah, I wish I could go back. Yes, back in time. History used to be the kind of girl that you would never leave. Yeah, yeah, yeah. She'd do anything to give me what I need for my disease. She'd do anything. I can hear them talking in the real world. Yeah, but they don't understand that I'm happy in hell with my heroin girl. Yeah, with the heroin girl. History. Overdose. Just another overdose.
you know what, Dub? You know, Shirley used to work at Festival.
Yes.
And there was a receptionist there who always referred to you as Duffhead. Yes. And she'd go, Duffhead's on the phone.
That's right.
So I often affectionately refer to you as Duffhead.
You have been listening to the BFM Historical Society, a weekly documentary series made to commemorate BFM's 40th anniversary. The Historical Society is broadcast every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and is available as a podcast from BFM's website later on in the week. The BFM Historical Society is produced by Dubhead.